Locked on. He fired. The missile streaked skyward in a plume of flame and white exhaust. Only a second later, before its crew could trigger their countermeasures, the Stinger exploded just below the helicopter's main rotor. Trailing smoke and torn pieces of rotor blade, the Pave Hawk tumbled out of the sky and crashed into the woods. Barushev started moving again, heading for the rally point secured by Kirill Aristov and his Spetsnaz troops. Once there, his KVMs would be loaded back aboard 3 FXR trucking semi-trailer trucks that had been specially converted to hide them. Then Aristov and his truckers would simply drive away, blending in with local traffic, and the Americans would be left without any clues as to where the enemy who'd just blasted Barksdale Air Force Base to hell had vanished. 17. Iron Wolf Squadron Headquarters, Powiat, Poland, a short time later. With his chin tucked against his chest and his hands up to protect his face, Brad McClanahan closed in to make an attack. Quick as lightning, his opponent lashed out with a straight punch aimed at his chin. He parried it and riposted, only to find himself striking at empty air as she danced away out of reach.
"You are slow today, Brad,"
Nadia Rozek said with a grin. There was a challenging gleam in her eye. She'd backed away across the padded practice mat and now stood balancing easily on the balls of her feet, obviously ready to react to any new move he made. This close to the dinner hour, they had the Iron Wolf gym all to themselves.
"Maybe you're just hellaciously fast," he countered. Then he grinned back at her. "Or maybe this is part of my cunning plan to lure you in closer."
"For what, a kiss?"
"Well, either that, or a good shot at a couple of elbow strikes and a quick leg sweep," Brad allowed.
Nadia dropped back into a fighting stance.
"Well then, come and take your best shot," she taunted.
They closed with each other again and exchanged a rapid-fire flurry of blows, kicks, and parries delivered with stunning speed and precision. Each of them landed hits that could have been disabling if it hadn't been for their protective sparring gear. Shaking off the pain, they broke contact a second time and fell back to their respective corners.
"Captain McClanahan! Major Rozek!"
Brad heard someone call. He glanced toward the voice, keeping a wary eye on Nadia with his peripheral vision. In the past, she'd proved all too willing to throw a sucker punch or 3 or 4 at distracted opponents.
"All is fair in love, war, and Krav Maga,"
was the excuse she'd gleefully offered. Mike Knapp, one of Iron Wolf's recon troopers, stood in the door looking worried.
"What's up, Sergeant?"
Brad asked.
"Captain Schofield wants you both in the communications center pronto,"
Knapp said.
"Somebody just whacked an Air Force base in the States."
An hour later, Brad, Nadia, and Maycomber gathered in the squadron's briefing room to go over what they'd learned. Polish President Piotr Wilk and Martindale were connected by a secure video link to Warsaw. Brad kicked things off by replaying the most comprehensive of the breathless news flashes currently flooding the world's airwaves and every corner of cyberspace. The others sat in silence, grimly focused as they watched Stacy Ann Barbeau's visit to Barksdale Air Force Base turn from a public relations triumph into a full-fledged national security disaster in the blink of an eye. Near the end of the short news report, he tapped a control, freezing an image on their wall-sized screen. Through their link to Warsaw, the same picture could be seen by Piotr Wilk and Martindale. It showed a scene of horrific destruction, a vast expanse of concrete strewn with wrecked and burning aircraft and dead or dying U.S. Air Force personnel.
"This bit of footage of the attack on Barksdale was shot by one of the local TV news crews assigned to cover President Barbeau's appearance on the base," he said. "The rest of the ladies and gentlemen of the press ran for cover when the first missile started screaming in."
"Can't say as I blame them," Maycomber grunted. "They don't wear the uniform, and TV ratings aren't worth getting killed for."
Brad nodded. "No kidding," he shrugged.
"Nevertheless, we're lucky these guys were either too gutsy or too dumb to bail out, because otherwise we'd be operating pretty much in the dark, relying on shaky eyewitness testimony about what just happened."
"Operating in the dark about what?"
Nadia Rozek asked carefully. This was the first time she'd seen these pictures. While Brad tried to make sense out of the reports cascading in, She'd been busy arranging this secure link to Warsaw and contacting Vilk in Martindale. She indicated the screen.
Isn't what happened obvious?
Someone, almost certainly the Russians, fired a large number of cruise missiles into that airbase.
Sure, Brad nodded.
But that's only part of the story. From what I can figure, those missiles were all aimed at fixed targets, at stuff like the control tower and hangars and other key facilities. They weren't fired at the F-35s, B-52s, and other aircraft parked out on the apron of Barbeau's dog and pony show.
That would make sense, his father agreed. Buildings don't move. Aircraft can. Setting up a coordinated cruise missile strike like this one takes time. Why take even the slightest chance that your warheads will detonate over empty stretches of concrete when you can guarantee hits on fixed installations?
Martindale's face frowned from one corner of the screen.
Okay, what am I missing here? He asked. If it wasn't Russian missiles, then what wiped out all of our planes?
Machines like this, Brad said quietly. He leaned forward and tapped the video controls to zoom in, allowing the others to take a closer look at what he'd found while reviewing these images. Though blurry, the picture showed a dull gray human-shaped robot outlined against the distant woods in the background. It was carrying what appeared to be a large machine gun or autocannon in its hands. Weapons of other kinds studded its long torso.
Watch, Boje. My God, Pyotr Vilk said,
almost too low to be heard. Makomer sat staring at the screen for a long, painful moment. His jaw was set. Then he glanced at Patrick McClanahan.
You were right, General. Charlie Turlock and I fucked up at Perunzeri.
Somehow we left enough pieces behind for that son of a bitch Grislov to build his own CIDs.
We all walked into that ambush, Whack, Brad told him with a rueful look.
It wasn't your fault.
My son's right, Colonel, the older McClanahan said.
Through the visor of his life support helmet, the lines on his face deepened.
Sooner or later, the Russians were bound to develop this technology. Exactly how they managed it is no longer important. What matters now is that we come up with a plan to handle what used to be our worst-case scenario.
Slowly, Vilk nodded. His face was troubled.
That is indeed the issue, General. And I must admit that I am not sure of our best course of action in the face of this surprise attack.
Caught off guard by the Polish leader's unexpected hesitation, Brad glanced around the table at Nadia, Whack, and his father, and then turned his face to Vilk and Martindale squarely.
With respect, Mr. President, I would think our first step is pretty doggone clear, he said carefully. We've got to deploy a CID-equipped Iron Wolf team to the U.S., and as quickly as possible.
He leaned forward, intent on making his point.
We all know what these robots can do. Under most circumstances, there's no way conventionally equipped U.S. troops, let alone any state or local cops, can tangle with the Russian equivalent of CIDs and survive, let alone win.
Not if Grislov's guys can operate covertly and strike at will, which sure as hell seems to be what he's got in mind.
Yes, that is true. But we have to consider the possibility that a campaign of terror aimed at your country might not be all Gennady Grislov has planned, Vilk said.
Brad frowned.
Meaning what, exactly?
This may be a feint, the other man said. The Russians could be attempting to lure the Iron Wolf Squadron's combat robots out of position before launching a new onslaught against Poland and the rest of our allies.
He sighed. Even without the services of its best Spetsnaz units, Russia's armed forces still substantially outnumber ours. Your CIDs are the key to our defenses. Moscow knows that, which is why sending your machines half the world away might be exactly what the enemy is counting on.
So we're supposed to just sit here on our asses while Grislov wipes the floor with the U.S.?
Makomer snapped.
Look, I've got no great affinity for Stacey Ann Barbeau and the assholes she has running things. But that sure as hell doesn't mean I don't love my country, or that I don't care what happens to it. Most of the people the Russians killed a couple of hours ago used to be my brothers and sisters in arms, and I will be damned if I sit back and do nothing.
I'm sure that is not President Vilks' intent, Colonel, Martindale said cautiously. His eyes were watchful. But he has a right to urge caution until we get a better read on the situation, and a clearer sense of Grislov's intentions. He shook his head. Besides, what can a single Iron Wolf team accomplish? Given the sheer size of the continental United States and the staggering number of potential targets, we have no realistic way to predict where the Russians might strike next. Without better intelligence, harrying off into the wild blue yonder would be unwise. Makomer snorted angrily. I'm not proposing some wild-eyed stab in the dark, Brad said flatly, working hard to sound calmer than he felt and diffuse the tension. Wack could have been a lot more diplomatic, but fundamentally he was right. There was no way the Americans in the Iron Wolf squadron could stand by and do nothing, not with their homeland under direct enemy assault, which made it his job to persuade Vilk and Martindale to take them off the leash. If you think about it logically, there's at least one site that has to be pretty high up on Grislov's list.
Very well. I'm open to the possibility that I've missed something obvious, the head of Sion said with a half-wry smile. By all means, enlighten me.
Oh, man, Brad thought, gritting his teeth. Martindale is so lucky that he isn't sitting across the table from me right now. You couldn't actually punch someone through a high-definition video link, which was too darned bad. And from the tight-lipped expression on Nadia's face, he'd bet she was thinking along the same lines.
The Russians are bound to hit Battle Mountain, he said quietly. And if they're smart, they'll do it soon.
On the screen he saw Pyotr Vilk sit up straighter.
You believe Grislov will try to destroy the Skymaster's facilities there?
He asked.
Yes, sir, Brad said. Right now we're almost totally dependent on a flow of CID upgrades, aircraft, drones, weapons, and sensors from Skymasters. They're the core of our current technological superiority over Russia,
a superiority that is already in serious jeopardy now that Grislov has his own combat robots, his father said somberly. Brad nodded.
Yep.
He looked pointedly at both Vilk and Martindale.
If we sit back and let the Russians destroy the labs, production facilities, and aircraft storage hangars at Battle Mountain, it's not going to matter how many CIDs we have holding down the fort here in Poland or the rest of Eastern and Central Europe. Not in the long run, anyway.
Ah, jeez, Makomer said grimly. The kid's right. Without the shiny Buck Rogers-style gizmo Skymaster supplies, we'd be in a world of hurt.
He turned to Vilk.
You said it yourself. We're already heavily outnumbered. If we lose our qualitative edge over the Russians, it's all over.
Slowly the Polish president nodded in agreement. Frowning in concentration, Martindale stroked his chin.
And if you're wrong and Grislov has other plans? He asked after a moment.
Then we recalibrate, Brad said.
At minimum, if we have a team already on the ground in the States, we cut our reaction time significantly.
There was a long pause while the two older men in Warsaw silently considered what he'd said. Then Vilk nodded again, coming to a decision.
What do you propose, Captain McClanahan?
That we fly 3 Iron Wolf Squadron CIDs and a recon team to Nevada, Brad told him.
Openly.
No, sir. We'll use the XCV-62 Ranger stealth transport to insert our force covertly.
You don't trust the goodwill of Stacy and Barbeau?
Martindale asked dryly. Brad shook his head.
Not so much as an inch.
Everyone else nodded their understanding and agreement. For 3 long years, Barbeau had stabbed them in the back every chance she got, even going so far as to send in a U.S. Special Forces team on a failed raid to sabotage the Iron Wolf Squadron's base and then ordering American F-35s to shoot down the survivors of a desperate raid on Russian missile bases. There was no percentage in giving her another opportunity to take a shot at them, especially since they knew she desperately wanted to get her own hands on CID technology.
Who will you assign to pilot the combat robots in this force?
Vilk asked.
I'll fly the XCV-62 in myself, Brad said. And then once we're on the ground, I'll take one of the CIDs.
He turns to Makomer.
I figure you'll want to run one of the others, Whack.
Damn straight, the bigger man agreed.
And I will pilot the third Iron Wolf machine,
Nadia Rozek said in a firm voice that clearly indicated she would brook no argument.
This isn't exactly your fight, Major, Martindale pointed out. If things go wrong, and this force gets nailed by the U.S. authorities, it's going to be tough enough for any American-born member of Iron Wolf. It would be a lot worse for a Polish national.
Major Rozek is right, Mr. Martindale, Piotr Wilk interrupted. Your people have sacrificed much to help defend my country's freedoms. Now it's our turn. Poland will stay true to its friends.
His eyes crinkled in a sudden smile.
Also, I suspect the good Major would probably mutiny if I commanded her to remain behind.
Mutiny is a harsh word, Mr. President, Nadia said demurely.
She smiled back at him.
I think I would prefer to characterize my probable response to such an ill-advised order as an unauthorized exercise of personal initiative.
You see, Vilk said to Martindale with an amused look, the matter is completely out of my hands.
18. Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. That same time. While two Texas Air National Guard F-16C Falcon fighters that had been hurriedly scrambled from Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland orbited overhead, Marine One came in low over the suburbs north and west of Dallas. Rotors beating, the twin-engine Sikorsky VH-92A helicopter flared in fast and landed just outside a huge 270,000-square-foot American Airlines maintenance hangar at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. The hangar doors were open, revealing a four-engine EB National Airborne Operations Center jet aircraft waiting inside. Inside Marine One, President Stacey Ann Barbeau stared out through the square window next to her seat. She could see a composite force made up of Air Force personnel, National Guard troops, regular Army soldiers airlifted in from Fort Hood, and airport police officers streaming out of the hangar. They spread out across the tarmac to form a perimeter around the helicopter. The head of her Secret Service detail, Rafael Diaz, came back from talking to the Marine Corps pilots up front. They'd flown her here after an emergency pickup from one of the greens on the Fox Run golf course just outside Barksdale.
"We'll open the forward door just as soon as you're ready to move, Madam President," he said.
Barbeau nodded shakily. Every bone in her body felt bruised and sore. And every time she closed her eyes, even for a few seconds, she saw images of those robots, those brutal killing machines, come striding out of the woods and then turn toward her. She gulped, swallowing down another wave of fear and nausea that seemed to come crawling up her throat. Beside her, Luke Cohen unbuckled his seatbelt and then reached over to do the same thing for her.
"We need to go, boss," he murmured.
In his ripped suit jacket and torn pants, the White House chief of staff looked as battered as she felt. Like most of her senior staff, he'd been hustled away from the attack in another of the armored SUVs belonging to her presidential motorcade. A few of her aides were still missing, probably left among the dead and wounded heaped across the burning airbase. Supported by Cohen's arm, Barbeau staggered upright. More Secret Service agents formed up around them.
"Tempest is in motion," Diaz said into his radio, using her assigned Secret Service code name. "Let's make this transfer fast and clean, people."
Marine One's forward door opened. Hot air swirled inside, mixed with the tang of jet fuel. Surrounded by Diaz and the other agents, Barbeau and Cohen hurried down the steps and out across the tarmac toward the waiting E-4B. The big jet was one of several Boeing 747-200s, converted into strategic command and control aircraft. Designed to remain aloft for at least a week with constant air-to-air refueling, they were intended to serve as mobile, survivable command posts for ranking U.S. military and government officials, especially the president, in the event of a serious national emergency. One of the E-4B's crewmen motioned them toward the forward crew entrance, up a ladder near the aircraft's nose. He saluted Barbeau.
"What are your orders, Madam President?"
"Get this goddamned plane in the air ASAP," she snapped.
She didn't want to spend another minute longer than she had to on the ground. If there was another attack by those murderous combat robots, this hangar was a death trap, no matter how many soldiers, airmen, and airport cops were posted on guard. They helped her up the metal stairs and into the plane, and then up another short flight of steps to the E-4B's main deck. From there, it was just a few feet to the small utilitarian office suite reserved for the National Command Authority. The aircraft's cockpit was directly overhead, up on the modified 747's flight deck. Gratefully, Barbeau dropped into one of the suite's big chairs. She fastened her seatbelt with trembling hands and then laid them flat on the desk in front of her, battling the urge to scream and swear at her staff to move faster as they scurried aboard and found seats. Outside, the aircraft's four huge General Electric turbofan engines started spooling up. 10 minutes later, they were airborne and climbing fast toward a cruising altitude of more than 40,000 feet. A uniformed Air Force officer, one of the battle staff permanently assigned to this command center, entered the compartment.
"We've established secure links to Admiral Firestone and the NSC, Madam President."
"Patch them through to here," Barbeau ordered.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he replied, leaning past her to flip several switches on the wall-mounted communications control panel above her desk. Its central video screen flickered to life, showing Firestone, the short, stocky chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in his office at the Pentagon, and Ed Roach in the White House Situation Room. She picked up one of the white secure phones. Cohen took the other. Barbeau took a deep breath. She knew that it was vital that she come across to these men as calm and in command.
"Brief me on the situation," she said tersely.
"We're now at DEFCON 3, Admiral Firestone reported, "and we are ready to go to DEFCON 2 on your order."
Barbeau shook her head.
"Let's hold off on that for now, Admiral," she said.
Moving to DEFCON 2 would significantly ratchet up the readiness level of the entire U.S. military, especially its remaining nuclear-armed and nuclear-capable air and naval forces. But it would also put the U.S. just two steps away from signaling a move to all-out nuclear war. She wasn't ready just yet to take such a drastic measure, not without more information. Ed Roach spoke up.
"The Vice President is on his way to Site R, Madam President."
Site R was an underground alternate command and communications center at the Raven Rock Military Complex in Pennsylvania, not far north of Camp David.
"He and his staff should be there in 30 minutes or less."
Barbeau concealed a sneer. She'd chosen Raymond Summers, a former governor of Ohio, as her vice president for purely political reasons during her first presidential campaign. She'd counted on him to swing his home state's electoral votes into her column. But that had turned out to be the absolute limit of his usefulness. Aside from an aptitude for glad-handing and spouting meaningless, folksy-sounding one-liners, Ray Summers had no real discernible leadership skills that she could detect.
"God help the United States if that fatuous moron ever lands in the Oval Office," she thought bitterly.
"There haven't been any other raids against our bases here or overseas," Roach continued. "And we see no indications of any additional overt offensive moves by the Russians or the People's Republic of China. In fact, there are no signs that their conventional or nuclear forces are even moving to higher states of readiness."
Barbeau felt cold.
"You're sure about that?" she demanded.
"So far, yes," her national security advisor said. "Satellite imagery and NSA signals intercepts haven't picked up any evidence of movement out of garrison by their major ground forces. The same thing goes for their warships and combat aircraft. At this point, all we're detecting are routine air and sea patrols."
"My God,"
Barbeau thought in dawning horror. Her suspicions about the attack on Barksdale, wild as they had seemed to her at first, were being confirmed. After all, why would the Russians or Chinese blow up an American airbase and then stop there? It didn't make any strategic or political sense for Moscow or Beijing to commit an outright act of war against the U.S. and then sit back on their hands,
leaving their own troops, ships, and planes completely vulnerable to any counterstrike. Nobody but a fool or a madman would do something that dumb. And while neither Gennady Gryzlov or Zhao Chang, his Chinese counterpart, was especially stable, she couldn't see either of them taking that kind of risk. With an effort, she regained her focus.
"What are your recommendations, Admiral?"
she asked Firestone.
"Even if we hold at DEFCON 3 for now, I strongly recommend moving elements of the fleet to sea as a precautionary measure,"
the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said.
"Especially our ballistic missile submarines," he grimaced. "Now that we've lost more of our long-range B-52 and XB-1F strategic bombers, those boomers represent most of what's left of our deterrent force."
"Absolutely not," Barbo said quickly. "If Gryzlov and Joe aren't putting their own military forces in motion, the last thing I want to do is trigger a dangerous round of escalation and counter-escalation. We simply cannot afford to stumble into another pointless confrontation with the Russians or the Chinese."
Which was probably just what the crazy bastard who'd orchestrated the strike on Barksdale Air Force Base hoped for, she realized abruptly.
"But we're already under attack, Madam President," Roch protested.
She glared at him.
"Tell me something I don't damn well know, Dr. Roch. I was standing right there when we got nailed. Remember?"
That shut him up. Barbeau scowled.
"It's time to face the facts, gentlemen. We were not attacked by Moscow or by Beijing."
"Then who?" Roch wondered.
"It was that scumbag Martindale," she said, "and his mercenary Iron Wolf squadron."
She saw the disbelief on her national security advisor's narrow, pallid face. Angrily, she snapped,
"I saw his damned CIDs shooting the hell out of our planes. Those robots were there, as big as death itself."
She gripped the secure phone tighter. She was not going to allow the dread those memories conjured up to show on her face or in her voice, not in front of these men. Instead, she channeled her fear into fury. Her voice cut like a knife.
"Do you know of anyone else out there with cybernetic infantry devices besides Martindale's Iron Wolf thugs, Ed?"
On the screen, Roch visibly flinched.
"No, ma'am," he admitted.
"I didn't think so," Barbeau said, not bothering to hide her scorn. "And the cruise missile strike that kicked off the attack is more proof of who's responsible, as if we needed any."
She turned back to Firestone. "Do the Russians or the Chinese have any long-range stealth bombers, Admiral? Bombers that could have launched those missiles and evaded our radar?"
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs shook his head.
"No, Madam President."
He looked thoughtful.
"Both Moscow and Beijing are working hard to develop long-range stealth aircraft, but they're not there yet."
"Which leaves Martindale," Barbeau said coldly. "And thanks to Skymasters, he has a whole slew of manned and unmanned stealthy aircraft in his arsenal, and plenty of missiles to go with them."
She gritted her teeth. "Only now, instead of using those weapons against the Russians, he's turned them against us." Roch frowned.
"I can't see what former President Martindale could hope to gain by destroying Barksdale," he said cautiously. "It's an act of treason, one we cannot possibly overlook or forgive. Why would he take that chance?"
"That's because you don't understand how Martindale thinks," Barbeau retorted. "He's always been a game player, and he sees people and countries as pieces he can move around on his chessboard. Well, by wrecking those B-52s, our B-21 prototype, and our first operational F-35 fighter squadron, he's just wiped out a sizable fraction of our frontline strategic and tactical air power, right? So with them gone, now what are we going to do?"
"I'm not sure,"
her national security advisor admitted. He shook his head.
"We can replace the fighter aircraft we lost in a few weeks, but working up another group of F-35 pilots and ground crews will take months, and rebuilding our bomber force will take years, especially now that we've lost the B-21 Raider prototype."
"Exactly," Barbeau nodded. "Which is why I can tell you what Martindale's plan is, Dr. Roch. He wants us so desperate that we're forced to fall back on the super high-tech gee-whiz weapons produced by his pals at Skymasters.
But you'll never buy into that idea, Roch pointed out.
No kidding, she snapped, which is why Martindale wants me dead or run out of office by that prick J.D. Farrell. Either way, he wins.
For the first time since boarding the E-4B, Luke Cohen ventured an opinion. He cleared his throat.
I can see where he might have been hoping to kill you, but...
His voice trailed off uncertainly.
Go on, Luke,
Barbeau said, irritably waving him on.
What's eating at you?
It's just that, whether or not Martindale had a hand in what happened today, this attack is going to backfire on him big time. And on Farrell, too, her chief of staff said. You're bound to get a huge boost in the polls from this. People always rally around the flag in times of national crisis.
Sure they do, she agreed bluntly. And if the election were going to be held in the next couple of weeks, I'd be sitting pretty.
Then her eyes hardened.
But November's too far off. Any polling bounce I get will fade over time.
And it will fade even faster once Farrell and his surrogates start pounding away on us for screwing up so badly. Cohen looked blank.
Oh, for God's sake, figure it out, Luke, Barbeau said in exasperation. Everybody in the fucking world just saw my strategic armament program go up in highly publicized flames. And whose bright idea was it to mass so many of our remaining bombers and our best stealth fighters in one vulnerable spot as part of a political show?
She felt her mouth twist into an ugly smile.
Tell me, how popular was General Short on Oahu once the bombs stopped falling?
Pearl Harbor, Roch murmured, suddenly catching her historical reference. She nodded. The stories her father, a career Air Force officer, had told her when she was young had sunk deep. Before the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, Lieutenant General Walter C. Short, who commanded the U.S. Navy's defenses in the Hawaiian Islands, had ordered all his fighter planes and bombers parked wingtip to wingtip so that they could be more easily defended against saboteurs. That made them sitting ducks when the Japanese Zeros came slashing in on strafing runs. The parallels were unpleasantly close.
19. Iron Wolf Flight Line, Povich, Poland, a short time later. Brad McClanahan finished entering his flight plan into the XCV-62 Ranger's main navigation computer. Then, methodically, he started clicking through a series of digital maps, checking and rechecking his work. Sometimes prepping for a mission took more time and effort than the flight itself. In this case, that wasn't true. He was facing a grueling 11,000 nautical mile one-way trip. Even with all the automation built into the Ranger's flight controls and several planned refueling and crew rest stops, he knew he was going to be pushing his endurance to its limits. When you threw in their need to avoid detection by radars and air patrols over several different countries, Algeria, Morocco, Colombia, Mexico, and finally the United States itself, the full magnitude of the challenge came into focus. At last, satisfied that he'd caught and corrected all the obvious and not-so-obvious flaws, he pushed a virtual key on his MFD. Mission plan accepted, the computer acknowledged. Minimum flight safety and fuel parameters met. Brad glanced across the cockpit at Nadia Rozek. The beautiful, dark-haired Polish Special Forces officer had her head down, studying her own displays. One of them showed a map of the North Atlantic. Colored icons indicated their best estimates of the positions of a number of Western and Russian naval task forces, including a U.S. naval carrier group operating off America's eastern seaboard. Circles of varying diameters showed radar ranges and the airspace within reach of routine air combat patrols for each group of warships. The circles moved and changed size and shape often, reflecting the flight path of E-2C Hawkeye radar planes on patrol. As Brad's co-pilot and systems operator, she was steadily working her way through Scion's most recent intelligence on any air surveillance radars or other threats they might encounter along their planned route.
At first, he thought she was completely focused, so intent on her task that she was entirely unaware of his admiring gaze. Then he noticed the faint smile hovering at the corner of her lips. Nope, he thought with inward amusement. The day he caught her off guard would be a first. She had more natural situational awareness than anyone he'd ever met, including Whack Makehomer and his dad.
I'm going to check on the rest of our gear, Brad said. Need anything?
Nadia shook her head. Not just yet, thank you. Her faint smile deepened. But I may want a foot rub or a massage later.
I'll pass the word to our flight attendant, he promised.
My God, that's not Colonel Makehomer, is it? She said, pretending to sound worried. Brad chuckled.
Nah, he's just a passenger. He jerked a thumb at himself. I guess I'm it, ma'am. Since I'm already the designated pilot, cook, bottle washer, and all-around general-purpose gaffer on this aircraft, what's one more tough job?
With a theatrical sigh of relief, Nadia got back to work. Still smiling, Brad opened the hatch and slid down the Ranger's crew ladder. He dropped lightly onto the hangar floor. Crews were working in every corner of the large bomb-resistant shelter the Iron Wolf Squadron used to prep its aircraft and CIDs for missions. Technicians and mechanics swarmed over the XCV-62, making sure its avionics, engines, and other systems were in tip-top condition. They were devoting special care to the four Rolls-Royce Tay 620-15 turbofan engines buried in the wing's upper surface. This was likely to be a long-duration mission, and Brad and his team would be operating out of rough, improvised landing strips the whole time. Losing an engine to avoidable mechanical failure was not an acceptable risk. He walked around the Ranger, making his own visual inspection. The STOL transport was around the size of a Gulfstream 450 business jet. It was big enough to carry 2-plus tons of cargo, or around 12 to 16 passengers. Between its batwing configuration and the special radar-absorbent material coating its surfaces, the aircraft had a remarkably low radar cross-section. While the Ranger wasn't in the same stealth league as an F-22 Raptor, which had the radar signature of a marble when viewed head-on, it was close to that of a B-2A Spirit bomber. The aircraft's rear ramp was down. Brad squatted down beside the ramp, taking a good look inside the troop compartment. It was overcrowded, packed from floor to ceiling with equipment, weapons, ammunition, CID batteries and fuel cells, and other spare parts. The three combat robots he, Nadia, and Makehomer would pilot were secured to bulkheads. They were powered down, seemingly lifeless. Six uncomfortable-looking web seats in two rows of three each filled the remaining space, provided cramped accommodations for Makehomer and a five-man Iron Wolf recon team commanded by Captain Ian Schofield.
Not a lot of leg room, is there? A cheerful voice said.
Unhurriedly, Brad rose, dusted off his flight suit, and turned towards Schofield. The Canadian had served in his country's Special Operations Regiment before joining Cyan and the Iron Wolf Squadron. His teeth gleamed white in a face weathered by years spent outdoors in all climates and seasons.
Afraid not, Brad agreed, with a note of apology.
If I said you guys were going to be packed in like sardines, you could sue me for overly optimistic false advertising. Then he matched the other man's wry smile.
But think of it like this. If we hit turbulence, you'll never know it, because you'll be jammed in too tight to move so much as an inch.
Schofield laughed ruefully.
There is that. We will be landing to refuel and grab some quick shut-eye at a few places along the way, so you and your men can at least get out and stretch your legs, Brad promised.
Ah, and these landing sites of yours would be an easy stroll away from various tourist spots, no doubt, Schofield said dryly.
Well, not exactly, Brad admitted.
Martindale has Cyan teams out setting up improvised airstrips and refueling points in the Western Sahara. Some are in the middle of the Colombian jungle and the Chihuahuan Desert in northern Mexico.
Schofield's easy grin flashed again. You see, I knew there'd be lots of nightlife for my lads to enjoy on this little jaunt.
Pardon me?
Nightlife, as in bugs, spiders, snakes, and other slithering creatures. Captain McClanahan.
The Canadian explained patiently.
the stuff of jungles and deserts, though not perhaps of pleasant dreams.
Brad shook his head in mock pain.
Ouch. You were this close to making me feel sorry for you, Ian.
He checked his watch. You'd best go round up your troops. We take off in 30 minutes.
Office of the President, Belvedere Palace, Warsaw, Poland. That same time. Polish President Piotr Wilk fought to control his temper as he listened to Stacy Ann Barbeau's wild, almost unhinged accusations. The American president's normally honey-sweet voice was full of dark rage. Although her image was grainy, distorted by the need to bounce encrypted signals from her orbiting E-4B command and control aircraft through multiple communication satellites, he could tell that same anger contorted her usually smooth features.
"What in God's name were you thinking, you stupid son of a bitch?"
she snarled at him.
"Are you looking for a war with the United States? Because I can assure you that is what's headed your way if you turned a blind eye to this massacre committed by Martindale and his mercenary soldiers."
"And I can assure you, Madam President, that no one from Cyan or from the Iron Wolf Squadron played any part in that monstrous attack on your country," Vilk said, choosing his English language words with care and precision. "I know those men and women. Whatever their political or policy disagreements with your administration, they are all patriots, every one of them. None would harm their homeland or its armed forces. If you doubt that,
oh, spare me the sentimental bullshit,"
Barbeau ground out through gritted teeth.
"Patriots don't fight for profit, and they certainly don't do so at the orders of a foreign government like yours, Vilk."
She leaned closer to the camera, an action that only magnified the ugly look of fury plastered on her face.
"You Poles hired a bunch of stone-cold killers because you were scared of the Russians. I warned you that was a dangerous move at the time. Well, fine. What's done is done. But what made you think you could control thugs like that forever? Because now it looks to me as though Martindale's dropped you right in the shit."
Vilk shook his head. "You are overlooking the obvious, Madam President."
"Like what?"
she snapped. "At my urging, former President Martindale contacted you some days ago to go over intelligence reports indicating that Gennady Gryzlov was organizing a deniable covert mercenary force of his own." Vilk set his jaw.
"Unfortunately, now we see what he had planned. That is why I worry that this Russian attack on your airbase is only the beginning of a much bigger and even more deadly clandestine war."
Barbeau snorted.
"Nice try, but no sale." "What do you... Martindale's robots," she said flatly. "His precious CIDs. They were there. I saw them. Hell, we've got pictures of them shooting up our planes and our people. Too bad your so-called warning didn't include any mention of the Russians building their own war robots. Since we all know that kind of technology is way beyond Moscow's reach, I guess you both figured that would be one lie I wouldn't swallow."
Vilk winced.
"At the time, we had no hard evidence that the Russians were building their own cybernetic war machines. Their appearance at Barksdale Air Force Base was as much a surprise to us as it was to you. We now suspect that Gryzlov was able to reverse-engineer CID technology from components captured when two of our machines were destroyed in action more than a year ago."
"How wonderfully convenient," Barbeau said with a cold edge to her voice. "So then, Mr. President, can you prove any of that? Or am I just supposed to bob my head and grin while Martindale screws me over for his own political ends and financial gain, and then walks away clean?"
For a moment, he could only stare back at her in dismay. Was the American president really so blind? So caught up in dark, paranoid dreams that she believed political rivals would be willing to commit treason to throw her out of office?
"Yeah, that's what I thought,"
she said dismissively. After a moment's thought, she shrugged her shoulders.
"Okay, so here's how we're going to play this, Piotr. You say the Russians did this.
with some mysterious new force of war robots? Fine. Then you give me your solemn assurance as Poland's commander-in-chief right now, with no ifs, ands, or buts, that all of Martindale's robots are still stationed in Polish territory, or elsewhere in your piss-ass alliance.
Frowning, Vilk glanced at the clock on his office wall. Brad and his team would still be on the ground, though only for another few minutes. He hesitated slightly, reluctant to sacrifice his personal honor in this way. Then he steeled himself. He'd sworn to defend his country and its freedom. If doing so required him to mince words to avoid confirming this woman's obsessive fears, so be it.
You have my assurance, Madam President. All of the Iron Wolf Squadron's CIDs are currently deployed in Poland.
Good, Barbo smiled unpleasantly. Now that we're on the same page, you better goddamned well make sure your hired killers stay put.
Her voice took on an even harder tone.
Because if it turns out that you've lied to me, and those damned machines are operating inside this country, I promise you that my government will hold Poland and its allies directly responsible for an act of war committed against us. An act of war committed on our own soil.
With that, she broke their connection. Vilk looked away from the screen. His eyes met those of Kevin Martindale, who'd been sitting quietly in a chair listening to Barbeau's tirade.
This is very, very bad. If any of our people are caught or killed now...
He let the thought trail off. Somberly, Martindale nodded. We're damned if they are, and probably damned in any case. If we abort the mission, we give Grislov free rein to wreak havoc inside the United States. His expression was bleak. And if we don't, and Brad and his team are spotted and identified, there's a serious risk Barbeau might go off half-cocked, which would pretty much guarantee that Poland gets crushed between the world's two most powerful nations.
20. Aboard the E-4B National Airborne Operations Center, somewhere over the United States, that same time. Barbeau swiveled in her chair to look at Luke Cohen. Her chief of staff had changed out his torn and singed clothes, donning an Air Force flight suit that was at least a couple of inches too small for his lanky frame.
Well?
Wilk was lying. She nodded.
Through his teeth. Dithering like that when I asked him to confirm the locations of those robots was the tell. So there's our confirmation. We were hit by Iron Wolf CIDs.
She frowned.
The circle I can't square is why Vilk would take a risk like this. Why allow his paid soldiers to attack us? Let's say their plan worked perfectly and I'd been killed. Even a buffoon like Ray Summers would have to retaliate against Poland big time once he took the oath of office. Vilk has everything to lose and nothing to gain from letting Martindale run wild.
Maybe the Poles really are as much in the dark about this as we are, Cohen suggested.
That would explain a lot. You think those Iron Wolf mercs have gone totally off the reservation?
Barbeau asked.
That they're acting without Warsaw's approval?
Cohen nodded.
Then why not just admit that right off the bat? Figure it like this. You go out and buy a big mean pit bull as a guard dog. And then one day the damned dog breaks out of your yard, runs off and mauls some kid to death. And when a cop shows up at your door, you say, "That's not my dog, officer,"
Barbeau said automatically.
Exactly. That may not be the smartest reaction, but it's natural.
She pondered that. All along she'd been sure that Pyotr Vilk would someday learn, the hard way, what the head of Cyan was really like. She'd certainly never bought the notion that Martindale would genuinely subordinate his own will to that of anyone else. Why would he take orders from some rinky-dink leader like Poland's president? His ego was too big. Right from the beginning, the former American president would have seen Vilk and his country as tools to be used and then cast aside when necessary. Barbeau grimaced. It was a good enough working theory
but she was getting tired of operating on the basis of half-formed and maybe half-baked guesses.
Okay,
so it's possible the Poles were blindsided by this, like we were.
But something else still bugs me.
Cohen went on slowly. The tall New Yorker looked down at his lap, deliberately not meeting her eyes, which was a sure sign that he was about to say something he was afraid might piss her off. She sighed.
Go on, Luke. I won't bite.
Cohen forced a nervous smile.
I understand what you're saying about Martindale, and how he wants someone like Farrell in the White House, who'll do things more his way. Not to mention letting Scion and Skymaster shove their snouts in a trough of juicy big-money Pentagon contracts,
she muttered.
Yes, Madam President.
Distractedly, Cohen ran his hands through his disheveled hair. But what I don't get is why Martindale would do something so obvious. He dropped his hands back into his lap. I mean, why not use Scion's capabilities for something slicker? Say, like sabotaging that B-21 prototype instead. Making sure our fancy new bomber crashed right in front of the TV cameras would have done more political damage to your campaign, without nearly as much fallout.
Barbeau considered that. Jesus, she thought. Cohen is right.
Something about this just didn't fit. Martindale might be a sneaky, ruthless, corrupt son of a bitch, but he'd always been a clever, calculating son of a bitch. Screwing around with the B-21's avionics, or even bribing its crew to fake an in-flight emergency, would have been a lot easier and safer stunt for him to pull. The kind of pulverizing, direct, all-out assault that hammered Barksdale into smoldering ruins wasn't his style. In fact, it was more like something that swaggering, shoot-from-the-hip, militaristic cowboy Patrick McClanahan would have thought was brilliant. But McClanahan was dead. She shivered suddenly, caught up in a memory that was 3 years old, but still had the power to give her nightmares. To persuade Gennady Gryzlov that the U.S. wasn't covertly supporting Poland in its war with Russia, she'd ordered Army Rangers and Air Force Special Operations Commandos to assault the Iron Wolf base. Their orders were to stop the mercenaries from carrying out a bombing raid on Russian missile bases near Kaliningrad. But the assault failed. And then the lethal-looking combat robot, piloted by McClanahan, had looked straight into a camera carried by one of her captured soldiers. Looked straight at her.
You are a traitor to your country, Barbeau, the machine had growled in its menacing, electronically synthesized voice. If we get out of this alive, I will make you pay. I promise.
Barbeau had believed him. That was one of the reasons, besides Gryzlov's threats, that he would launch a wider war that had prompted her to order American F-35s to shoot down every Iron Wolf plane that survived the attack in Kaliningrad. She'd been determined to make sure that Patrick McClanahan really was dead this time. It was the only way she could think of to stop him from fulfilling the terrifying promise he'd made. Her pilots had obeyed their orders. Blowing the last two Iron Wolf XF-111 Super Varks out of the sky. No one had heard anything from the retired Air Force General since then.
Until now, maybe,
she thought in growing horror. Could McClanahan somehow have survived, again? It seemed impossible. For all his skills, he had been a man. As mortal as any other human being. He wasn't a machine. No. She thought desperately. Patrick McClanahan is dead. He had to be dead, because otherwise he'd be coming for her. Involuntarily, Barbeau's hands tightened on her chair's armrests. Her face felt numb, as though it were carved from stone.
Madam President?
Cohen said uncertainly. He looked worried. She forced herself to let go of the chair.
I need you to get in touch with Ed Rauch right away.
She said. Her voice sounded strange in her own ears, as if it was coming from millions of miles away.
Tell him I want the NSA and other agencies to re-examine every piece of intelligence that led them to conclude Patrick McClanahan was killed when his X-111 went down over Poland 3 years ago.
Her chief of staff stared back at her.
Do you think I don't know what to think, Barbeau countered harshly. But if there's a chance, any chance at all, that psychotic bastard is still alive. I need to know about it.
RKU Security Detachment TX-151, Loop W, near Texarkana, Texas. A short time later, perched high in the cab of his FXR trucking-registered 18-wheeler, Kirill Aristov checked his side-view mirror. He could make out the unit's two other big rigs stuck in the traffic jammed up behind him. They were all separated by at least 10 to 15 other vehicles, which made it less obvious that they were traveling in a convoy.
Not that any of us are going much of anywhere right now, the former Spetsnaz captain thought irritably.
A long line of cars and trucks bottlenecked this stretch of single-lane highway, looping around Texarkana. They were stopped dead. Up ahead, maybe a mile or so, he could see what was causing the holdup. Flashing red and blue lights where police, ambulance, and fire crews were working to clear a serious accident that had blocked the highway.
Spectre lead to Checkmate 1. What's going on up there? Why are we stopped? Is there a mechanical problem with your vehicle?
Colonel Ruslan Barushev asked suddenly through Aristov's headphones. They'd rigged up an intercom between the truck's cab and the trailer it was hauling, enabling communication with the pilots of the two KVM robots hidden aboard.
We're fine, Colonel, Aristov assured the other man. We're just stuck in traffic. The local American authorities are clearing a wreck ahead of us. Once they're finished, we'll be moving again.
Are you sure that isn't a security checkpoint set up by the American military or spy services to hunt us? Barushev snapped. This so-called accident could be a ruse.
Aristov exchanged glances with Nikolai Dubrinin in the passenger seat. The other veteran Spetsnaz trooper rolled his eyes. The captain shrugged his own shoulders in a wordless reply. Their passengers were still jumpy. Barushev and his KVM pilots seemed to be taking a long time to come down off the adrenaline high they'd experienced during their attack on the American Air Force base.
We're already more than 120 kilometers from Barksdale, sir, Aristov said patiently. That's well beyond the zone of any likely search. The Americans would have to deploy thousands of soldiers and police to cover all the possible roads and highways this far out, and they simply do not have that kind of manpower available to them.
Let us hope you are right, Aristov, the colonel replied. Stay alert. If you are wrong here, and there are American police and military units blocking our path, my machines will eliminate them.
And the intercom went dead. Dubrunin shook his head.
Those guys are a little too kill-happy for my comfort, Captain. If it's all the same to you, I'd rather make it to Dallas without having their robots burst out of those trailers and start shooting up the whole highway.
That makes two of us.
Aristov saw the traffic ahead of him starting to inch forward. He reached down to put the big rig in gear.
Let's hope they calm down once we reach the warehouse and get them out of those metal suits.
The Kremlin, Moscow, a few hours later. Gennady Grislov prowled back and forth across his office like a caged animal. From time to time, he paused to check the newscasts streaming across the screen of his smartphone. But never for very long. After the first deeply satisfying images of burning aircraft and dead Americans, no new information had emerged. Instead, journalists around the world were busy doing what they always did in times of crisis, replaying the same tired video clips, indulging in pointless speculation, and interviewing the usual groups of experts, none of whom could shed any useful light on events. He was getting tired of waiting. In his view, patience was a virtue desirable in underlings, not for those with real power. A soft chime sounded from his phone. He stabbed the answer button icon.
Yes.
Mr. Kurykin has arrived, Mr. President,
his long-suffering private secretary, Ivan Ulanov, announced.
By your orders, I have not logged his arrival.
Good,
Grislov approved. Now that things were heating up, it was time to make sure there were no obvious connections between Russia's head of state and Vladimir Kurykin's private military company.
Send him in.
He spun on his heel and sat down at his desk, while Ulanov ushered the head of RKU into his office. A curt nod sent his secretary scurrying back to his post. He waited only long enough for the door to close before demanding,
"Well?"
"Our attacks were completely successful," Kurakin reported. It was clear that he was